U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Friday afternoon. Good Friday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio. The skies are starting to clear. The morning clouds and rain are moving out, and looks like we're going to see a lot of sun on this holiday weekend, Passover, of course, tonight. We'll talk to Tom Gimbel a little bit later in the program. He does an annual survey about the class of, so what does the class of 2019 expect in the job market? Frank Sennett will be along a little bit later, too, to talk about, well, we just have fewer choices at our McDonald's drive-thru. It's kind of sad, actually. But we start on Fridays with Andrea Haines from the Chicago Tribune, who is in the studio. Andrea, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, so there are several stories in the business section of the Tribune this week that surprised me, that I wasn't aware of. First of all, the first one is the scooters, that rideshare scooters. I don't know what to call them. Rideshare is not the right term, but you know, that you can just like Divvy bikes, but scooters. The scooters now are more prevalent in the U.S. than are the bikes.
I know, isn't that surprising?
That was very surprising. And I was thinking of the health experts who thought, well, here we are, finally a way to get some exercise. There are going to be bicycles all over the country. It doesn't look like it. There are more scooters. Not only are there more scooter rides being taken, there are a lot more scooters already around the country than there are bikes.
There are a lot more scooters. And so Chicago's been slower to enter that world. So maybe our perception is a little bit skewed because here Divvy has been so popular and so talked about. But nationally, scooters have really taken over. And a lot of times when they do enter cities, the providers put a lot of scooters on the ground. So the numbers are big.
And so what's the disposition of them in Milwaukee? Are they in Milwaukee now? I do know, because I remember there was a whole, one of the companies just dumped them all over the place. And that was sort of an idea of how to do it badly, or how a city needed to be prepared, was sort of a lesson for Chicago, right? That's why we're going so slowly.
Yeah, and the test city I was actually watching myself was Bloomington, Indiana, which is where I went to college. And I know they had a lot of issues with it. So I was keeping my eye on it there. And they did the, maybe similar to what you're talking about. They banned them. They're now thinking about letting them back, but with more rules. Because what happens is, you know, they don't necessarily, like a Divvy, have to be locked to a particular docking location.
Well, I was going to ask that. So they're not docked.
Yeah. So there's different ways. There's a lot of different vendors and a lot of different options for how they can be. But what they've been in a lot of places is you grab it, you drop it when you're done, theoretically maybe off to the side, but they're just kind of almost littered along sidewalks, and that is what has caused a lot of the controversy about
them. So there was an editorial in the Tribune this week about this, and a good point that when I first started hearing of these scooters, I was thinking of mopeds in some ways, but they're like the Razor scooters that your kids have.
Exactly, yeah. People think of like Vespas or that kind of scooter, which is the same name, but these are electric-powered scooters, like the kind that you ride on standing up. So you see them occasionally in town. I've seen one here or there. I tend to see them in River North if I'm driving home that way. But what happens when the companies come in, they're these venture-backed companies. You know, Uber's in the business, Lyft is in the business, Ford has bought a startup that did scooters. So there's some big money companies in it, and they will come into a city. You know, one of the numbers that Uber was mentioning for Chicago, which this is not happening right now, but they were mentioning the number 20,000. So it
wow.
could potentially be quite a lot of scooters.
And there is money there. Riders took 84 million trips on micro mobility services, so shared scooters or bikes, in 2018. 84 million trips. That's more than double they took the year before.
Yeah. And, you know, it's maybe $2 to take a quick ride. So I think they could be popular, kind of for getting from point A to point B. Or if you end a train ride, you've got a little further to go. You can see where it would fill a gap.
I took one in L.A. earlier this year.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
No,
how was
not
it?
L.A. Maybe San Diego. I was a little scared.
Yeah. From what I hear, they're not necessarily super comfortable for very long rides. So they will probably be confined to pretty short little stints.
Yeah. I went about a third of a block.
Oh, really? Well, maybe you need a little longer
than that. My daughter had it. Like, wait, it will take some getting used to, I think. Okay. Another story that got by me was this Car2Go story, which is a car sharing program, right?
Yeah. Speaking of these shared vehicle situations.
And they stole like 100 cars in Chicago?
Yes. So it looks like about 100 cars, mostly Mercedes-Benz automobiles, they're a little maybe unclear so far on what they think happened. It sounds like it was some kind of fraudulent use, maybe through the app. They did say that legit customers were not, like they didn't have their profiles invaded
right.
or anything that was a security risk to them.
So this is a deal where you go on the app and they tell you where there's a car parked and you can go and drive the car?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and they've just combined with another company, so they actually offer a lot of different services. but it was one of these app-based kind of situations. And they've, I think, recovered quite a lot of the vehicles. But what this led to was Cartigo ceasing operations in Chicago temporarily.
Well, I think
because
so.
They just have to get a handle on what's going on.
No one's been arrested or anything like that just yet?
It's all in progress, so we'll see. I think they actually have found and or arrested some people, and okay. they've recovered a number of the cars. So we'll be looking for an update on this in the coming days.
You know, we talk a lot about tech here and about Apple, Samsung, and all of that. And one of the big new developments in smartphones is this foldable phone. We've been talking about it for years. Samsung is coming out with one. You can buy your foldable smartphone from them, I think, later this month. For the cool price of, what, $1,988 or something?
Yeah, so
like
it's a $2,000 phone. It folds.
Oh, if you round up, it's
$2,000. Pretty awesome.
Sure.
Sorry, I didn't calculate out the cents, the dollars and cents for you, but it's approximately $2,000, and it goes on sale next week.
I can't think of any reason not to buy one unless, well, they break right away.
Yeah, so this is not what you want to happen when you're a tech company with a hot new product, right? They sent previews out to journalists who would be reviewing them. And guess what happened? They started breaking. And that's with obviously fairly light use on the first day or two that journalists, you know, had
right.
them. So it's kind of alarming. But, you know, and the Samsung stock price took a dip after that. They don't seem all that alarmed in that they haven't canceled, you know, they haven't moved the order date or seems to have canceled shipments. So they must think it's a one-off. Maybe they sent journalists the bad ones, although I don't think that's what you would do
move.
When people
well,
are reviewing it.
There's something about a glass shield or a shield on the screen, and some people were taking those off. Or...
Yeah, that was a wrinkle. There was a peelable kind of shield, which some of the journalists took it off. And, you know, there wasn't any reason not to think you would take it off because it looks like a protector kind of thing.
Right.
So it may be that if that's kept in place, people have better results. So, you know, Samsung will need to communicate.
But this would be
that.
A big deal if they start selling these phones for $2,000, the most expensive phone ever.
Brutal.
And you
yeah.
can't even play solitaire on them for a week.
I tell you. And, you know, Motorola has one coming and some others too in terms of bringing back that foldable design.
Right.
So it will be interesting to see how, you know, how they hold up.
Real quick, Uber has come out with a new, they're going to start advising people a little more strictly about who their driver is, right? There's a terrible story about a woman at the University of South Carolina got in the wrong car and was killed.
Yes.
And Uber's, I mean, not that they've got a way to fix that, but they're trying to remedy it in a way.
Yeah, so Uber is going to try to just remind people is basically what it is, because they have things in place, right, where you can see what's the car color, what is the car make and model, what's the driver's name, what's the license plate number, all those things you should check.
I was in Mexico, I got in the wrong car.
Oh, did you really?
A few
yeah.
weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, I guess you kind of have to be, I guess I'm paranoid, so I kind of do check, or I expect them to say my name or something, but it's just a reminder to people, because often, you know, it's late at night, or you're in an unfamiliar area, you have other things on your mind, you may not think to do all of that, and it's obviously a crime of opportunity, it's probably not going to happen all that often, but they are sending reminders, push notifications to reminders, to just say again, here's the name, here's the car and what the car looks like and all those things you're supposed to be checking.
Andrea Haines from the Chicago Tribune. Read more at chicagotribune.com. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Steve.
It's 12:21. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Tom Gimbel is in the studio. He is the CEO of LaSalle Network. And welcome back. Nice
happy
to see you.
Easter. Happy Passover.
This is awkward. I meant to show you this off the air. But so WGN is doing a trip to Prague for the Blackhawks opener.
Oh.
How about that?
I didn't even know that it was up. That's awesome.
I know. I got the tickets. It was a difficult thing to do, but it'll be a Steve Bertrand travel trip.
Really?
And I can set aside two spots for you.
Let
if you
me
want.
Know. Send I mean, maybe. You
pay
never know.
Full fare.
You know what? It's kind of like you coming to my holiday party. I think there's a shot this year.
touche. Anyway, though, the Blackhawks just sent out an email to all their season
That's
ticket
cool.
holders this morning. So I'm starting to get a lot of
Well,
demand.
You know what? I'm actually not going against you, but I'm more of a Bears guy, and I'm debating if I'm going to go to London.
You know, people have asked me if I could have gotten tickets for both, and I had a hard enough time to get the Hawks tickets.
Yeah.
So there's info's up at SteveBertrandTravel.com if you want to go. We kind of have to have our numbers in a week or two. But pretty cool trip. I thought you would
I will
it.
Take a look out for sure.
Okay, so it's graduation time.
Yep.
Coming up on graduation time. The job market for the graduates still red hot, I would imagine?
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah.
The economy, the things are still going really, really well, and I see it not ending for the foreseeable future. And unemployment's under 4%, which is great. It's good for everybody. It's great for kids graduating college.
Why is it better for them than others?
Because if you can't find people, you'll take the best available athlete, right?
Okay.
So I can't find the 15-year experience person I want, so I can hire somebody who's just aggressive and they're educated and they're coming out of college. Wow, I'll hire some of those.
So is it still a case of I don't know who the buyer or seller would be in this case, but that
it's a seller's market.
Right, so the would-be employees
yeah.
have more power than the employers.
Yes, at the moment. Now it gets a little gray with college graduates and what the volume of hiring is
right.
and where companies are going, but this is if there's a time to be graduating, you know, my son's a freshman. I'd rather be graduating now than in 3 years.
Right. Well, my son's a junior, and my daughter graduated last year. She was in perfect
position.
Yeah. Next year, how am I going to do?
You'll be okay still.
Okay.
Yeah. Kid's screwed.
What are the Gen Z graduates mean? What are their priorities?
So it looks like number one. So we surveyed over 3,000 people at LaSalle Network, 3,000 soon-to-be graduates. Number one, opportunity for career growth, career advancement. Number two, work-life balance. And then number three, compensation.
That's amazing to me. I keep hearing those numbers that come. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I guess when you first get out of school, money's not the most important thing.
Well, you know, and money may be 10% if you're making $150,000 and 10% at $35,000
right, right.
is a different number.
And so we talked last week, didn't we, about work-life balance? Mm-hmm. What does that mean to these kids?
So it's really just the standpoint of does a company's culture allow me to be, is it going to be like the stereotypical investment banking private equity where they're working me 80 hours a week? I mean, I think if you talk to some people, they think that leaving, you want to be able to work wherever and whenever you want. Somebody else, it's, I'm not going to have to work weekends or evenings.
Right.
It really is, once you find the job, it's then, do you like it? And then it's, how much are you working?
So, you know, we had this conversation in our house because my wife started to work as an accountant, and she was working for a pretty big firm,
mm-hmm.
a real estate firm, and was working 60 hours a week. I mean, that's just what they did.
Yep.
And so Emma, who's graduated more recently, you know, she's in an environment where she can work from home 2 or 3 days a week. She
right.
can do the, you know, it's just a completely different feel.
And she'll still, not that your daughter, but, and then they'll get that opportunity and then they'll still complain about certain things.
Well, I mean, right? How do you think it came up? Right?
And your wife's like, you have no idea what it was like.
But is that truly the case everywhere, or is it still industry by industry?
No, I think you're 100% correct. Is your analogy is that people will complain no matter what the situation is. The problem in today's day and age.
Yeah, but I'm not thinking of complaining, Tom. I'm just thinking of the work-life balance of it. That it's
no, it depends on industry. Listen, teachers complain about certain things and they get 3 months off.
Ooh, accountants, I wish you hadn't said that. Here come the text.
Accountants, well,
actually, they're still in school,
yeah,
so we're okay.
Hopefully. It's factual. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's factual. Accountants complain about things, and they know. If you know what it is when you get into an industry and then you complain, you're a complainer. If something's thrown on you and you complain about it, you're wondering why.
Okay, so what sort of, even though money might not be important to them, it is to their parents. Right. So what kind of cash are these?
Well, we can spend, you know, you don't have enough time for me to
right.
be on to talk.
Right.
Parents are the problem.
What do you mean? About demanding too much money?
Yes.
Really?
For the kids, right?
You don't get calls from employees.
I don't, but I've had kids who have quit and said, my parents say I work too much. My parents say I'm not making enough money.
Really?
Yes.
So I started by saying this generation has it much more, I'm not going to say easier, but much more relaxed. And what you're saying is that it's the parents putting the pressure on them to relax more.
Oh, I think that you know, I've said this to parents and to kids. I've said, when you were at college, and if you were saying, I can't go out tonight because I have to study for a final, did they ever tell you, don't study so much,
right.
go have... No, because it was their, if their parents were fortunate enough to pay for it, they would say no, because it's their money. Right? When it's the employer's money, they want the kids to have more freedom and more fun.
That's pretty cool. That's the view from Gen Z. We're going to actually talk to Erin Lowry after the headlines, and she wrote a book on financial advice for millennials,
mm-hmm.
which I would imagine is quite a bit different.
Well, yeah, I just quote my father, Bill Gimbel, and he always said, spend less money than you make and invest the difference.
That's kind of hard to do for some people, I think.
There's a lot of things that are hard to do for some people, Steve.
Tom Gimbel, great to see you again.
Good to see you.
Thanks very much, Dave Schwann. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on Chicago 720 WGN. Chicago's very own. It's sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Steve Bertrand here on this Friday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. Frank Sennett will be along a little bit later to talk about changes in the McDonald's menu. It's all about the drive-thru, I think, with fast food, and some of the signature sandwiches were slowing them down. So we'll talk to Frank about that. But right now on a phone line is Erin Lowry. She is the author of the book, Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. Brooke, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start out. Were you a broke millennial?
I was. I was living in New York City on $23,000. Can't think of getting much more broke than that.
And so how did you turn things around, or what is it that motivated you to sort of make a change?
Well, it actually wasn't about making a change. I had always been very confident with my money because I was fortunate enough to grow up in a household where we talked about money a lot. That amount of money was actually kind of self-imposed. I was working in the entertainment industry, and I was actually working three different jobs, and that was as much money as I could make. But I still felt very much in control of my money, and I wanted to make sure that other people could actually feel the same way. So that's why I started sharing the stories.
Do you find that millennials, and I'm the owner of I think among the youngest millennials. My daughter was born in 96, but do you find them as a class to be particularly well-informed when it comes to savings and investing, or ill-informed?
And I am a millennial myself. I'm 29 years old. And I would say it's a mixed bag, just like with any generation. Part of it does depend on how much you had access to financial knowledge growing up, how your parents taught you about money or talked about money, as well as the just overall sense of finances in the house. Whether or not you had a lot is not so much the question as how it was discussed in terms of, was there tension? Was there a lot of stress around it? Was it really kind of a negative experience for you growing up? But luckily for us, the development of technology has made it much easier for us to get access to information. But on the flip side, there's so much out there,
well,
it can feel overwhelming.
Yeah, we were just talking about that earlier this week, too. It's kind of hard to know, because it's easy to type in a Google search, but it's hard to know sometimes when those results come in who is sound and who is not, or actually who is more sound than the others.
And I would say a big part of that is making sure you source a variety of opinions and options and not just taking one. And one of my favorite quotes in the second book, Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, was one of the experts said to me, if you go on a site like Reddit, the advice is worth exactly what you paid for it,
right,
which is nothing. Keeping that in mind.
But you can find good stuff by not paying for it, right, by doing the right search sometimes, if you find the right source.
And you can, and I think a big part of that is making sure that the source is credible. So whether that is looking online, one of my favorites is either Investopedia or investors.gov, which is sponsored by the SEC. There are a bunch of options and opportunities out there. Now, part of it sometimes can be that the language feels very intimidating and overwhelming,
right.
So it can be kind of a slow process of understanding what people are saying.
Well, that's your wheelhouse, isn't it? I mean, from what I understand, the approach you take and the language you use is very accessible for people who are trying to just get started or get a handle on things.
It is, and especially with the second book, I like to consider myself a translator. I do not call myself an investing expert because I'm not, and especially at the tender age of 29, I've mostly experienced a pretty good stock market run, so I don't even have a lot of experience with the ups and downs, and I think that's a really important thing to note. And I do try a very narrative in how I write, and I try to bring storytelling angles into it because I think it's much more palatable that way.
You know, it's very funny you bring that up, Aaron, because when I was 29, roughly, I think I had benefited from the same thing, the dot-com sort of run-up, and then I ran into the bubble. But, yeah, I thought I was quite an investing genius there for just a few years.
And I think for me, I'm a history nerd, and so just knowing the history of the stock market, I'm prepared for what's to come.
All right, so let's talk about a couple of scenarios. Millennials, everyone says they're drowning in student loan debt. It's all about paying that off. What do you advise people when it comes to paying off the debt compared to investing in their future, right? There's got to be, is there a give and take there? Is it all about the student loans, or how do you advise people with that, or what do you suggest, I should say?
You do need to have a balance. There is an entire chapter in my book dedicated to this question because it really is a biggie for millennials. And I asked every single expert, and by and large, almost unilaterally, the response was you need to consider the interest rates on your loan, 5% being the cutoff. And what they meant by that is if your student loans are at 5% or higher, probably just makes more sense to aggressively pay down the debt. But if it's under 5%, well, you could balance in and the math could work out. But there's a big caveat here, and that is your retirement account. I think so few people consider themselves investors when they have access to a 401k or an IRA and are funding it. But you are an investor. Problem is, we say save for retirement, not invest for retirement. We need to change that language.
So
if you do have student loans, pardon?
I'm sorry. So your point is that it's not enough just to put your money in a 401k. You're an investor, so you've got to be educated about where you're putting it in that 401k?
Well, it's also that you are an investor if you're putting money into a 401k, and a lot of people don't think that they are. I've had that conversation so many times. So when you do have student loans, you should, in tandem, also be putting some money away into a retirement vehicle, whether that's a 401k, whether that's an IRA. But if you do have the option for an employer match, try to at least get that. And if that feels too much, start at 1% and try to work your way up by pushing up an extra 0.5% or 1% every 6 months until you're at least getting the employer match.
Are you a proponent of socially responsible investing? I mean, I guess who would not be? But could you, do you agree that you can get the same returns by investing socially in a socially responsible way, or do you not hold that view?
I think same returns, it's hard to say based on everybody's portfolio being a little unique. There are definitely more options now to be investing in a way that aligns with either your ethical or moral or even religious beliefs and still get good returns on your investments. But my other thing, too, is it's not only about the returns, it's also about diversifying. So just making sure that no matter how you're investing, you're not putting all of your money into just one sector or one type of investment. And that's one thing that people do need to be really careful about when they're looking at SRI compliant funds.
Speaking of that, are you a proponent of buying individual stocks or funds?
I am a fund investor myself. I did actually go through the process of buying an individual stock pretty much just for writing the book. I have a chapter about it in the book that mostly starts with, not saying you should do this, but I know people are going to ask, so here's some information. I think if you want to do it, if it's something that interests you, just make sure that it's an amount of money that you can stomach losing.
Yeah, I think, you know, we lose track sometimes of the fact that the day-to-day fluctuations of the stock market are not the sorts of things that those of us who are investing for our retirement should pay that much attention to, right? I mean, what goes up one day, down the next, where it's more of a long-term thing. And if we start trying to pick stocks, you could end up losing, being lost in all of that.
You can, and especially if you're just in the beginning stages, you really need to be focusing more on that value investing, buy and hold type strategy and thinking about the long-term game here. But if people are interested in it, something they want to try, just using a small speculative part of your portfolio in order to kind of scratch that itch could make sense. But that's really not what I advocate for being a majority of your overall investing strategy.
Aaron Lowry, if you had to tell millennials listening or their parents listening one thing about saving or investing right now, what would it be?
I would say your greatest advantage is time.
Yeah.
You need to start now.
Yep. Aaron Lowry, the name of the book is Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. Enjoy talking to you. Hope we can do it again.
Thanks. And I will actually be in Chicago on May 15th.
Well, there's a reason to stop by, Aaron.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope to speak to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Well, that didn't take long. The legal scuffle that Westlake Hospital is going through with the county in Melrose Park has been settled. And despite the operator Pipeline Health wanting to close the hospital less than 6 months after they bought it, they must keep it open. It was a decision that the Illinois Supreme Court handed down. And a Cook County judge also decided that every day they're not open, they will face a $200,000 fine. They've only owned the hospital for 3 months. But anyway, that'll sort itself out. Hey, drones! Do you know that there's a Chicago company called Valkyrie that might have sorted out the drone delivery issue when it comes to actually dropping the package at your door? They're creating a smart drone-accepting mailbox. It's still in the works, but the idea is that it would work with all of the delivery drones by keeping the packages in a secure way. And don't worry, for those who live in condos and apartments, they're working on a building version as well. We'll keep all those package pirates at bay. Shiver me timbers, you be spoiling my business. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you very much, Lauren Lapka, Dave Schwann, sorry about that, Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is a Friday afternoon. On a phone line is Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. Frank, welcome back to the Biz Lunch. It's looks like it's sunny out there. You're going to take in some baseball this weekend?
Yeah, maybe Easter Sunday at the park wouldn't be bad.
75 degrees, and I'm thinking the wind's going to be blowing out, so things could be good there.
Yeah. Even if you like a pitcher's duel, it's fun to see him hit it out of the park once in a while.
Yeah, it's fun to see the pitchers hit it out of the park because they can do it on days like that.
Right.
You know, so the McDonald's across from Wrigley Field is gone, and McDonald's is a franchise that has been Well, they're not struggling, really, but they're continuing to sort of maneuver and to try to find their way. They announced earlier this month that they were limiting their overnight menu and getting rid of some of the fancier sandwiches. And then there was word, I think it came out yesterday, that they're getting rid altogether of some of their signature sandwiches. I never have tried one, but tell me about that and why they might be doing that.
Yeah, so this is to me, as a McDonald's customer, fairly regular, I had not tried any of these either, so that might tell us something.
Yeah,
right? You and I had not tried them. So they're really focusing on more their popular, you know, tried and true quarter pounders, and they're doing a couple variations, a quarter pounder deluxe that's going to be new, and a quarter pounder bacon burger. And so that was introduced for a limited time in January, but that's going to become a mainstay part of the menu. So it seems like less than a huge change. It's like, let's focus on kind of variations on the core thing that us longtime customers will gravitate toward, and less on the new stuff that maybe wasn't catching on as quick. But it sounds like a similar product.
All right, what's your go-to when you order?
Well, I love the Big Mac, but I often order off the dollar menu because I'm cheap. But I do, when they do those two Big Mac specials, I like to go with somebody and, like, you know, each get a Big Mac. And
this is a money show.
What's yours?
That's not cheap. That's being frugal. You know what? This is crazy because I don't eat at McDonald's that often, but I have eaten there a couple times in the past couple of months, and I can't get past the double cheeseburger meal. I don't know why. I go and I should try something new. I haven't had a Big Mac in 30 years, I bet. I haven't branched out.
It's the tang of the special sauce that gets me.
I would have the chicken sandwiches sometimes, but I think some of the chicken sandwiches are among those what they're getting rid of.
I mean, some of the high-end ones, right.
And I did a little research or some work with McDonald's a few years ago, and it's all about the drive-through, which didn't occur to me. They're always talking about how they're trying to cut down on their drive-through time. And one of the things was that these signature sandwiches, they just took longer to make.
Yeah, there's more ingredients. They have to be more fresh prepared, all that stuff that we like to eat, but it's hard to keep the assembly line churning.
So McDonald's, I saw this recently, their average drive-through time, I think, was 5 minutes. And they were last when it comes to the major food chain. So we're not even willing to wait 5 minutes for, which is amazing. And a majority of their businesses are done through the drive-through lanes, I think.
Yeah.
So Easterbrook has been doing this. They're, like I said earlier, I don't think struggling is a fair way to describe it, but they are sort of trying to find their way in this 21st century, right? Is that a fair way to put things?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're seeing more, you know, store concepts that have a lot of, like, touchscreen ordering, and they're trying to do away with some of the dollar menu items, get a little more upscale. They've gone to more fresh ingredients, you know, the all-fresh quarter pounder, you know, and not frozen. So, you know, I think that is more accurate than to say that they're struggling. They're really just trying to find what's their 21st century groove.
Yeah, and they can do whatever they want as long as they don't touch the French fries.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, let's jump from the dollar menu to the $300,000 menu. Joe Cahill has an opinion piece in Cranes about the University of Chicago and Northwestern University, and how it's essentially could cost soon, or does cost now, about $300,000 to go there.
Yeah, that's with tuition and food and lodging. There's a look at the 2019-20 academic year tuition, kind of the sticker price, up 3.9% at Northwestern, tuition to $56,000, up 4.3% at the University of Chicago, up to $57,600. So, you know, you're looking at around $300,000 if you pay full boat, do the room and board. And then, you know, so Joe Cahill is basically making the point that there may be a lot better economic values out there with some state schools, you know, like a Purdue or something like that, in terms of the bang for your buck. But one of the things that he points out as well, that, you know, I was a beneficiary of 30 years ago, back when Northwestern was only $11,000 a year, it actually, you know, the American story worked for me in terms of higher education because of the financial aid I was able to get. I came out and was able to go up a socioeconomic class over what I had grown up in. And so, you know, they're saying that a lot of this tuition increase, they plow that back into that kind of thing. So, you know, if anybody out there is glad that they hear me or whatever, that maybe is a positive thing. Or maybe you're like, oh, I wish they wouldn't let in the riffraff like him. So,
I was going to refer to your story because it's a great story, and you've been very clear about that. Without the assistance, you wouldn't have been able to go to Northwestern, and that's where some of this money goes. But Cahill writes that over the past 20 years, tuition and fees at private national universities ranked by U.S. News have gone up, again, over the past 20 years, they've gone up 168%, more than triple the rise.
It's a huge increase, for sure.
And I understand, I'm happy that they're giving scholarship money and things like that, but it just seems, it's just out of control, and I think we're going to be in for some sort of implosion in coming up. I don't know how it's going to end, but I think things have just got to change.
And the other thing that you see that's being impacted with immigration policies and everything is that a lot of schools, to your point, in terms of where's the pool of people who are going to pay the full boat, you know, fewer and fewer Americans are, you know, looking at these elite schools and saying, yeah, at full sticker price, we'll take the plunge. And so they're getting a lot of the people in the same way that state schools try to get out-of-state students to pay the out-of-state tuition. A lot of these elite universities are really relying on international students to come in and pay that full sticker price.
Right.
And so, you know, if there's a tightening of immigration or if there are fewer people that want to come over here because they perceive there may be some issues, then that could also be a pincer.
That's one of the things. I mean, that certainly is the case at University of Illinois, right? People complain about it, but the fact is that there's a lot of money coming in at a full rate that is helping that school.
Yeah, absolutely. And there have been stories in Cranes and other places about that, even having an office dedicated to marketing to international students. You know, they have people that are basically ambassadors, marketing experts who do the white glove treatment to try to get, you know, some wealthy foreign students coming in. And, you know, it really does help the overall bottom line for the schools.
Well, I certainly am glad you were the recipient all those years ago.
I'm getting old, man.
And I am, because I get a chance to listen to you every Wednesday afternoon. Oh, in this case, Friday. We'll talk again soon, okay, buddy?
Thanks, Steve. Everybody have a great holiday weekend.